Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron. Here we go. Slow down. Bruce Cameron, along with the great Justin Nimmergood.
Hey, everyone. How's everyone doing today?
All right, another beautiful day in the neighborhood. So today we have a special show. We have a special guest with us. Today our show gets to take a little bit of a international turn, which is good because the Concierge Coaches Show and our tribe is worldwide, you might say. So without further ado, I'll introduce our guest today. We have Dr. Christian Perrin with us. And thank you for coming on the show. And if you would, go ahead and introduce yourselves to our listeners and let us hear more about you and your background and what you're doing.
Yeah, of course. Well, firstly, thanks for having me on the show, and it's a pleasure to be part of it. My name is Christian Perrin, and I have a background in psychology, ultimately. Quite a varied background, and I'll be talking today a little bit about how my interest in many different areas of psychology has kind of culminated over the years, and how that's ultimately evolved in me doing more work on coaching individuals to achieve personal goals, and also working in environments to enhance how people communicate, how people negotiate. My background is actually in forensic psychology. I've worked in a number of prisons in the UK and abroad. And I've also worked in clinical settings with people who suffer with a range of mental health issues. And then outside of that, I've had several different business interests. And I suppose at the moment where my head is at and what I'm doing is I've realized that all of those different backgrounds have kind of culminated in something which is ultimately about influence, about caring for ourselves better, and about kind of becoming the best possible self that we can be. I suppose I should also say I'm from Manchester, from the UK, but at the moment I'm traveling quite a lot, living in Singapore, traveling to California a fair bit as well, which is of course where I'm at Justin. And so I'm sort of doing a range of things, working with a number of companies on a consultancy basis, and still doing quite a lot of work in the field of forensics and clinical psychology as well.
That's great. Go ahead, Bruce.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, thanks again, Christian. Really, really great to have you on our show as kind of our first official guest to kick off our new format and obviously partnership between Bruce and I. Just to give the listeners out there a bit of background or a bit more background on Christian and kind of the genesis of our relationship and why I thought he'd be a great first guest to kick us off. You know, we met this past summer. Christian has been spending the last couple summers anyway out here in California where I'm based. And, you know, it was one of those relationships, and I would say friendships, that you meet someone and you sort of instantly, you know, I like to say fast friends, right? And it was within a couple seconds really of talking to Christian that I knew he was not only, you know, quite brilliant, but just had a message that was compelling to share with the world. And as we developed our friendship and partnership, business partnership, you know, throughout the summer, he's actually, I've had the pleasure of having him on to coach and train one of my sales organizations at Vablet, you know, which I'm obviously conducting a project for right now. And he just has absolutely brilliant work. So I'm honored and privileged that he was able to join us here. And just for you listeners out there, he's on the other side of the world. So he's actually tuning in. It's about 3 a.m. his time. So we're fortunate he was able to kind of hang on with us here this afternoon here on the West Coast. So Thanks again, Christian. One thing in particular is we kind of pivot here and tee up some of the discussion for today, right? And I think really drives home this concept of coaching, right, that Bruce and I talk about week in and week out is, you know, maybe you could share with the listeners out there a bit of your background on the psychology side of the house, which is actually quite similar to some of the counseling work that Bruce has done. You know, would you mind just sharing a bit about kind of your background and how you've evolved that over the years into kind of more of a coaching framework?
Of course, yeah. For me, it all started really at a charity in the UK that deals with depression and suicidal thoughts. I actually started working at this charity called Samaritans in the UK, which is, I think it's Europe's largest charity that deals with people who are suffering with those kinds of emotions and feelings. And so I volunteered at this charity for a number of years, and I was listening to people over the phone that, again, were dealing with traumatic events in life, that were going through periods of depression and finding it hard to get out of that. We're experiencing, you know, spirals of anxiety and those kinds of things. So really quite intensive phone calls with people that are just calling, just people from the public calling up to get some sort of support. And I started to realize, you know, trends and themes, I suppose, when I was doing that work in what people were really suffering with and what kind of help they needed. And then at the same time, I began to work in prisons in a number of different contexts with different kinds of offenders, ranging from very serious offenders to what we might consider more petty offenders. And what I started to learn from those two different sort of modes of interest were that people experienced quite similar things, whether or not they were experiencing suicidal thoughts, whether they were locked into criminal behavior, and that actually most people want the very similar things from life. So people want to be competent, they want a level of autonomy, they want a degree of meaningful relatedness, meaningful relationships, and they want to be able to engage. And so I realized that with striking similarity, many people that go through periods in life when they're not very fulfilled and not happy, they're often sort of lacking these things that we all want in legitimate ways, but we sometimes maybe not able to achieve them or access them. And so my role as a coach has been to evolve that and to create something of a framework. I mean, I'm a bit skeptical about frameworks. I think human behavior is very complicated, and I don't think we can just instrumentalize behavior. But some sort of framework on how to support people to become the best kind of possible self. And again, that framework is about how to develop a sense of mastery, you know, how to be competent in whatever it is that you want to do, how to do that autonomously and to create your own autonomy and what that means to you, how to relate to those around you and what really is a meaningful and impactful relationship, how does that look to you, and then ultimately how to engage with society around you, how to engage with the people that are influential around you. And I've come up with some practical ways that people can do those things, which perhaps I'll talk about later.
It sounds like such a great combination of, you know, clinical skill and what you're doing now. And I'm excited also to see how you apply that to the business sphere. I myself retired from the federal prison system here in the United States, and did a lot of work in prisons with mentally ill and sex offenders. And it's really amazing how that translates so well into the private sector and to the business world. So I'll be interested to see how it sounds like you've made a similar journey with all those great skills and abilities to bring that to a different venue. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, it's been it's great, isn't it, when different avenues of life all sort of come together. And again, people sometimes laugh because I seem to have so many different interests, and people will think that they traditionally wouldn't complement each other so well. But I guess what you come to realize, especially when you're dealing with human behavior, is that we're all quite similar in many ways. And we, you know, we can often suffer with a similar sort of issues in life that stop us from achieving what we want to achieve. And I think that's what I've learned throughout my career so far, is that, again, it doesn't matter if you're in the Samaritans, where I was listening to people's innermost thoughts, or whether you're in a situation of conflict in a prison environment, or if you're in a sales environment trying to, you know, close a sale. There's many similarities in the way that you should go about that interaction. And many, many ways that you can sort of care for yourself during those times to make sure that you're the best that you can be.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point, Christian. And by the way, you know, for the listeners out there, you know, as a PhD, you think oftentimes PhDs are you know, kind of on the older side of the house. Christian, not to put you on the spot too much, but exactly how old were you when you received your PhD degree again?
29.
That,
I rushed everything.
One of the younger PhDs that I've ever had the privilege of meeting. And, you know, as you spoke, Bruce, there about kind of the delineation point between, you know, kind of clinical and obviously practical, you know, private sector. I'm curious, you know, Christian, just your perspective on what you've seen, not only from that delineation point, but also having spent time, obviously extensive time overseas and also here in America. You know, perhaps you could just give some of the listeners your world perspective on what you've seen as well.
I guess what I see a lot of is pressure. People are under different kinds of pressure, whether it be in jobs or personal relationships or whatever else it is. And the consistent theme that I've experienced globally is that, again, people are under some sort of pressure that they are forced to respond to. And there are ways of doing that in a more healthy way. And so some of the things that I've seen that are very impactful is trying to coach people to use practical tools and mechanisms to ensure that they deal with the pressure of whatever event it is in a better way. So, again, techniques like identifying sort of personal ambitions and setting small goals and watching the achievement of those, and using techniques like mindfulness. I think there's a bit of an issue now with mindfulness. Everyone's talking about we need to be more mindful. But I think there are ways of escaping the pressures of life that can be very helpful. So I talk to people a lot about ways to do that. And more recently, I've been talking a lot about the importance of compassion in every environment, and how to sort of express compassion by things like actively listening to people, by communicating more effectively. And I've been talking a lot about transition as well, how to deal with changes in life and how to be kind of more resilient, I guess, to those sort of changes. But to answer your question about sort of global kind of trends and what I've found to be consistent themes of what are important to people, I think it's all those things. You know, people want to feel competent and autonomous, and like they have meaningful relationships in their life, and that they're achieving something. But there are ways of really zoning in on those areas and supporting someone through that to ensure that they're generally getting more out of life, that they're happier.
Well said. Well said. Maybe, you know, I'm curious, and I'm sure you've got plenty to draw upon, but, you know, would you mind sharing your favorite story, either from kind of your past work and more the clinical side, or your present work, you know, just in working with individuals? I know you had, I mean, you've shared several with me, you know, about your time in the jail system, but could you share with the listeners your favorite story and kind of walk them through the process that you took your patient through?
Yeah, can do. Well, there's many from different realms, I suppose. There's those that I was speaking to at the Samaritans and coaching through things like depression. There were those in the prison environment. And then there's been those more in sales environments and in the business world. My favorite stories from the days in prison were ultimately those that were about conflict and about managing particularly volatile or aggressive offenders. And that's the moment when I'm under a lot of pressure to not say the wrong thing and not to inflame situations. And so I would always use a lot of techniques with prisoners who just didn't want to deal with me at all and who were maybe scared of the fact that I was a big, scary psychologist who was going to try and analyze them. So I would use, again, techniques like I would just use a lot of silence and interactions. I would allow prisoners to lead the interaction often, and I wouldn't force through any of this notion of power imbalance. Prisoners are often very afraid that, that they've not got much power in the interactions that you're having with them in prison, of course, because they're behind bars. So I would use practical ways of reducing this sort of power imbalance. I would try and use humor quite a lot just to break down any barriers between us. And there were some ways that I did that I suppose were quite humorous. I'm not sure I'll share. It's not one of my biggest achievements, but one of my clients' biggest achievements recently was overcoming a massive public speaking phobia. And I worked with this client on, and it was a fellow lecturer who was suddenly going through this immense anxiety when they were stepping up to do a lecture to 200, 300 people, which obviously is not good if you're a lecturer. And so I worked with that person on what the root of the anxiety was. And again, sort of taught them how to inject humor maybe into lectures to reduce tensions, to use techniques like putting videos at the start of the lecture and then getting up there at the front and just standing there and breathing and being more mindful in order to settle into the lecture a little bit more. And then, of course, I've used sort of techniques in relationships too. At the Samaritans, I was dealing with every now and again healthy relationships and what that looks like and how to compromise in a relationship. So there's been a number of different sort of what I would say kind of wins over the years and work that I've particularly enjoyed. And a lot of that as well has come in the sales environment, which I may get to in a little while if you want to ask me about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I do want to get into certainly the sales environment, as I'm sure Bruce does. I'm curious, Bruce. I heard something Christian said, and I was just curious from your standpoint if you used any of those techniques when you were working with the prison systems.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have very, very similar techniques, you know. The whole dynamic, I mean, the folks are under duress, I mean, for the most part, right? They're living in this controlled environment and those things, and that can bring out the best in people. It can also bring out the worst in people sometimes. Goes for the clients as well as the therapist or the clinician. So yeah, I mean, it's there's probably some differences in the culture. You know, I would think the prison culture here, as it might have been in the UK. But we use a lot of cognitive behavior techniques, and you know, there are a lot of self-limiting thinking that we all struggle with, and certainly you're reminded of that, you know, in prison, you know, on a daily basis, and certain holidays of the year are harder than others, and then dealing with suicidal inmates it's just a whole other skill set, right? To really and be with the person, do the suicide risk assessment, but also get them to a place where they can at least come to that acceptance point, you know, of where they are right now, and that there's also some hope, you know, hope for the future. And when you're hopeless and you're helpless, you can be stuck. And so I think as coaches, right, we kind of get in there where that person had that phobia or there's other some sort of sticking point where the person is hopeless or helpless in a particular area. And we get in there and help them find their way out through us being assisting them through that journey. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing that I've found particularly powerful is the importance of things like trust and the importance of other people's perception of an individual. You know, academically speaking, I've written quite a lot on stigma and on about personal identity and how that affects social identity. One of the consistent themes that I find when working with people across different contexts is that people identify themselves by what they do, their routine activities, whether that be, you know, what football club they belong to, what sports they do, if they're into healthy living and how that looks for them, their relationships. And so how a person makes sense of their own personal identity allows them to kind of then build out from that and build relationships and make sense of their place in the world. And if that identity is not a healthy one, or there's negative inputs, then of course that person's environment tends to be more negative. But when people are able to break out of that, it's usually because they're able to envision what Marcus and Aurelius, great scholars in the field, call possible selves. People need to be able to identify practical, possible future selves, and think about what that looks like. You know, what is current self looking like? What sort of traits do I want to have? What states do I want to be in? And how can I achieve that to move towards something that looks better, healthier, and happier? And again, that's why I talk a lot about transition and about techniques to kind of make forward steps.
100%. And speaking of transition, you know, let's transition to more your recent, recent day contextual work, if you will. As you've evolved into a bit of a sales mastery trainer, right? Certainly, I know I've experienced it, and our team at Vavlet has firsthand. You know, maybe just start with kind of your inflection point, Christian, and what made you decide to evolve your work past kind of the public sector, or what we call in America certainly the public sector work, you know, working in the jail systems and whatnot, into more of the private sector work, and specifically around sales and art of persuasion and some of those techniques that I know you have been chomping at the bit to talk about here.
Yeah, it's just I never thought really in a million years that I would end up sort of working in perhaps a sales sort of coaching environment, just because I've had such a different background. And I probably never saw the crossover between clinical settings, forensic settings, and sales. But I suppose, again, the connection sort of point is all about rapport and about, again, how we communicate. What I realized about the sales environment, and sorry to all those sales snipers out there, is that many salespeople aren't that great at it, actually. And it's because humans are vulnerable to things like automation. We don't like to be forced into an automated environment. So when we can feel like people are selling to us, this automated thing goes off in our head when we sort of panic and we want to get off the phone, we want to leave the interaction because we feel like we're being manipulated. And so I've focused on training people who sell stuff on how to move away from that kind of that approach of selling, which is very much about force and about the seller dominating the interaction. And one thing that I've done is develop a different idea of what rapport is. If you speak to, or certainly I did some recent work for a company in the US, and I asked the managing director, who's the best salesperson you've got in the team? And give me, you know, half an hour with them. And the first question I asked this person was, what's rapport building? And they talked about being liked, about keeping the person on the phone, about, you know, making them feel at ease and whatever else. And that's one thing that I've sort of challenged, because actually rapport building probably isn't this sort of conversational, small talk kind of context, which is about how are the kids, those football scores lately, you know, how's life kind of conversation. Rapport building in a sales environment should be about allowing the customer to see the value of whatever it is that you're proposing to them. And so rapport can still be a nice conversational approach, but it can be around the needs that a client has and about the value of a product. And to do that well, you have to be prepared to sacrifice your talk time on the interaction. You know, it's good salespeople tend to listen more. They tend to empower the client to talk more about what is important to them. And they do that by asking open questions. And all of that allows then for ethical selling as well. So this idea that you can force someone, I can make someone buy anything, this kind of Wolf of Wall Street kind of mentality, isn't really helpful. What is helpful is creating space where you can allow people to see the value of whatever it is you want them to see the value of in an ethical way. And that's one thing I've been working on lately, how to do that by developing strategies of conversing in a more effective way and using principles of influence.
Yeah, and this is so huge, you know, and for the listeners out there, I want you to kind of tune into this in particular, this piece of what Christian's sharing, because we have a lot of listeners that are either coaches today, or they're exploring transitioning into the coaching, you know, world, right, and becoming a coach. They have been a coach, or some coach in their corporate practice, and or a lot of entrepreneurs out there as well, right, that perhaps tune in to our podcast just for guidance and little nuggets of wisdom and success. And the one thing that's consistent, regardless of whatever profession you're in, you're selling something. And at a minimum, you're selling yourself, right, as a valuable, trusted advisor or whatever context you want to utilize it in. So this idea, and this was a big moment for me too, Christian, you know, of rapport and what is rapport. A lot of these concepts are really archaic, you know, that we see today. And I really loved how you put a new twist on it, right? It's a fresh lens, if you will, on the whole sales approach. And you know, for us, you know, for me in particular, it was a very eye-opening moment just to see how some things I was doing were kind of wrong, you know, in today's modern day age.
Yeah, I mean, one of the classics, I think, that maybe people don't appreciate when they go into a sales kind of interaction. And again, when you ask me about stories, I think the best moments as a coach for me are when I have someone who's really objecting, you know, someone who's really not wanting to listen to what I'm saying and is challenging me and saying that they know everything there is to know about sales and they've tried this and whatnot. And I had one of those recently, and someone was saying that they don't agree with asking open questions, and actually you should ask closed questions at the start of a call so that you can qualify people or whatever else. So I said, okay, well, let's do a little role play. And this company was, I'll anonymize it a little, but an accommodation type of company. So I was selling different kinds of accommodation. And I said, okay, let's go. Let's ask some closed questions. So the person, so I pretended to answer the phone, and the salesperson was saying, do you use Airbnb? So I said, no. And then, do you use Hostelworld? So I said, no. And I kind of said, right, where are you going with this? So he said, well, you're just being awkward now. You're just saying no, but most people do. So I said, okay, phone, you know, call me again. So I answered and I said, do you use Airbnb? So I said, yes. And then, do you use Hostelworld? Yes. So my point was that you're not extracting any information by these questions, and actually you're not engaging the client in any way in a conversation about why whatever you're about to sell them is useful. So instead, saying things like, can you tell me about your experience at the moment being a property owner? Even if you get a short response, you're going to get some qualitative information to work with, and that response might be, things are okay, could be better. And again, you've got something there, you've got a nibble, something to sort of extract and talk about. Okay, can you tell me about things that could be better? Well, I've got a bit of a nightmare booking things. I have to manage all the booking myself, and I'm very busy. Right, well, actually, a platform that we're using does all that for you. can you tell me something else? So by creating a more interactive and open conversation, you're able to extract more information from the client and again, ethically explore how your product can help them and enhance their business or life. And so it's interesting that these small techniques can be quite profound, and they can have a profound effect.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, and if you wouldn't mind, and you've got a couple of them that I want to make sure you share, you know, before our time's up today, because you're just a man full of stories, Christian, I have to say. One of my favorite things about you. If you wouldn't mind sharing along the lines of this concept of archaic rapport, I know one of my eye-opening moments was after you shared the story about your experience, and it's kind of going back again, but in retail, right? And where you were kind of pitted on a seasonal basis up against your counterpart there and kind of won out the position. Would you mind sharing a bit about that story? I think it's a nice tie into this piece.
Yeah, again, I talked earlier about how different experiences from life tend to culminate and interact and come together at some point. And I didn't realize what an impact that time in my life had on me. But I was working in a high-end clothing store, high-end gents clothing store. And initially, I didn't get the job that I went for. So I'm talking about negotiation here, but initially I flunked it. And that's because I kind of turned up with a criminology degree, thinking that I was some sort of someone important, and probably maybe I was a little arrogant and overconfident, and I didn't get the job initially. And who did get the job was a woman who we'll call Crystal. And so Crystal was recruited, and then 6 months later, I was recruited to work over the Christmas period. And in the first month that I was working there, I outsold Crystal's previous 6 months. Quite considerably. And eventually the store manager, Stu, said, right, Christian, okay, hotshot, you know, I want to see what's going on here. Said, you know, why are you so good and whatever? And I said, well, it's a combination of me being all right, but Crystal being very bad at this. And I said, just watch. I said, when someone comes in the store, what Crystal's doing is she's developing rapport, but she's kind of doing it all wrong. And then, sure enough, this guy comes in the shop and Crystal says, hi, how are you doing? What brings you to town today? So the guy says, you know, oh, I'm actually going to the game later on. I'm just having a mooch around, you know, just having a look around with my kids. Oh, great. Oh, where are the kids now? Oh, they're with the wife. They're just in a restaurant. And immediately what she's doing is taking away the context of why the person's just walked into a store, which is obviously to get some clothes, hopefully. And what she's doing quite harmfully is creating a confusing interaction. The customer doesn't know whether they're there to buy clothes or whether they're there to talk about the football scores or whatever else. And also, she's killing any obligation that the customer has to buy anything, which is important. When we talk to people about buying something for a while, we start to build obligation. And that sort of sounds unethical, but what I mean by that is we're telling them more about the products that we're offering, and therefore building this expectation that they're gonna buy it because it's valuable to them. What Crystal's done is she's actually given permission for this guy to walk straight out of the store because, as far as he's concerned, he just came in for a conversation about small talk. And so so Stu said, okay, right, you go. So someone comes in the store and I would say, hi, welcome to the store. What is it you're looking for today? And at that point, the person might say, nothing, I'm just looking around or whatever, or they might leave. If they do, then I was never going to close that person anyway, so I've saved everyone's time. But usually they'll say, oh, just I'm kind of running low on T-shirts or whatever. And then I would say, all right, and I would ask open questions. It may seem a bit bizarre, but what kind of T-shirts do you wear? Well, I'm actually guilty of wearing a bit too much white. Okay, well, have a look at this, have a look at that. We've got these new fresh T-shirts here. And I would engage them in a rapport sort of sense, but it would all be about the products that we're offering, and it would be conversational and friendly. But what I was doing all the while was getting the customer to describe to me what it was that they wanted to buy. And so at the end of it, all I've got to do is go away and present them with what they've described And then, of course, they're kind of obliged to buy it. And that's because of the psychological principle known as the interpersonal consistency principle. Once somebody's on several occasions what it is they want, they're going to look a bit stupid to back out at that point. It's the same principle that explains why people won't ever back out of a political argument once they've started it, because they look weak. And so I was becoming at that time very aware of a number of different principles that were very effective. Things like the reciprocity principle. Once you have done a small favor for somebody, they will likely respond very generously. So if you need to, you talk about, oh, today I can give you 20% off this. They'll usually reciprocate and they might actually buy more. So I was becoming aware of rapport building, but also how to insert a number of psychological strategies which are about influence and negotiation in order to, you know, be more effective as a salesperson. But I think the crucial thing I want to get across is that I was always doing that in an ethical way. I was always making sure that people were obviously getting value out of whatever it was. And of course, in every crevice of my life, in every effort that I may make to influence someone of an outcome that I want, I would like to think that I've done that ethically.
That's real good. It's almost like that pre-hypnotic suggestion there, right? I mean, like you said, get them to talk about what they want to get and then offer a solution, and that's right in line with what they're saying. And like you said, they're more likely to respond in kind. So I think that's a great illustration on how to communicate with people and kind of join with them in the moment. You know, it's kind of mindfulness in a way because they're in a men's clothing store. You know what I mean? So it's not very mindful to ask, well, where are your kids at? What's their favorite color? And you're straying from the goal like that. And I'm sure you saw a lot of that when you were training, you know, the rookie therapists, you know, desperately clinging to get their client to talk. So got to stay on point and on task, but kind of gently lead them down that Roman road to the cell of sorts. So I really like how you laid that out. And I'm sure, you know, when you're working with clients in the business area, you know, teaching them something like that, if they don't already know that, would be highly useful.
Yeah, I mean, and I suppose these are quite intricate little sort of psychological resources that we have that may sort of seem obvious, but people aren't really employing them. And they can be incredibly effective. And the other day I was talking to one of my friends whose boyfriend wasn't allowing her to go out, you know, the classic possessive sort of relationship. So she said, you know, I really want to go out with my friends and hang out with everyone, but it's getting weird when I want to go out. So taking on this one, I thought, you know, right, okay, I'm going to do some moral good here. I'm going to sort out a controlling boyfriend. And so I said, okay, when you're communicating about your relationship, start to say things like, one thing I love about our relationship is the fact that you're always letting me go out and spending time with friends. You're always letting me do this. And I love that. It makes me feel, you know, valued. And I think it puts value in our relationship. And what you need to be doing there is inserting the idea that your boyfriend is actually this chilled out, laid back dude that will let you do kind of whatever you want, hang out with your friends. Because people usually want to actualize these possible selves. And those are very good, positive traits and good things to be. And so bit by bit, sure enough, the boyfriend starts to say, oh, thanks, I love that too. You know, yeah, go out, go and enjoy yourself. Because what she's done is obviously impart the idea that he is a different kind of possible self. And that's much different than saying, let me go out tonight.
Unless she's a borderline personality. Oh my God, you don't love me then?
But there are sort of different ways of negotiating it that, again, I've sort of used in the past, and maybe this has been a little unethical, but there's a difference in the business world of telling people to do things and getting them to maybe do things because it's helpful for everyone. So, for example, if I were to say, right, Justin, go and sack that guy that we work with tomorrow because he's not effective. I want you to go and sack him. I'm putting a lot of pressure on Justin. I'm inserting him into an anxious environment and ultimately ask him to do something that he might not want to do. Instead, if I said, Justin, I'm struggling at the moment. I don't know what to do about this chap that we work with. You're so good at communicating with people and you're really good at managing conflict. I wish I was better at that. You're great at it. And then later on, if I said, would you mind going and sacking that guy? Would you mind going and dealing with that individual because, you know, you're so good at that? Maybe it's a little manipulative, but there's a better way of encouraging someone to do something.
Hey, is that paper or plastic on that stuff? Okay. But no, I think it's really good. I mean, you're bringing up some very, I think, tried and true, almost basic, but very solid human communication techniques. You know, part of my mind is there's always this, you know, hey, I'm looking at your picture. Of course, I look at a Justice picture and you guys look of the same, you know, of the same millennial cloth. You know what I mean? So I was like, okay, here we go. We're going to have a little millennial fest here. And these guys are going to really, you know, in other words, the culture has changed. The people have changed. You know what I mean? And of course, you know, in that demographic, I mean, you guys are, you know, in your late 20s, early 30s and whatnot. But anyway, but it's so refreshing for me as the old guy over here, kind of like, okay, you know, this is really, really good stuff with a relevant, you know, with a relevant delivery in the world we are in today. It's just a pleasure to hear.
Yeah, thank you. I think, like you say as well, you said basic. I think I would agree with you, actually. I'd say a lot of these principles and little tools that we have are quite sort of basic, and that's what makes them so sort of valuable in a sense and so usable. We can insert these fairly classic notions of psychology into our daily lives, but we can do them in quite a special way, at special moments, to make us more effective. And I suppose that's what I've been working on, how to insert these little tools of wisdom and these practical mechanisms into different areas of our lives.
Excellent. Well, I know we got 3 minutes left, and I know we want to be able to have folks know how to be able to reach with you, interface with you, and be it worldwide or in California or Singapore or wherever you may be. So I want to make sure we have adequate time for you to share all those connection points.
Yeah, great stuff. So obviously email is the key bit of information there. So my email address is just christian@astralnegotiations. So the company that I'm doing all this work under is Astral Negotiation. That's because it obviously takes mainly in a negotiation stance. So that's Astral Negotiation. So christian@astralnegotiation.com. So people can reach me there. And then from that, I suppose I'll probably share numbers, and then we can keep in touch on a more sort of informal basis.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Justin, you have anything to add before we wind it down?
Well, you know, I just, it's been a pleasure, Christian. And, you know, for the listeners out there, hopefully you took, I know I certainly did. I was sitting taking copious notes over here, because I feel like every time I talk to Christian, I learn something new. And, you know, if you want to learn something, certainly around this idea or framework of psychology of sales success, and I would say in the modern day workforce, you know, mm-hmm. He's definitely your guy. So, you know, you get my endorsement 100%, you know, in the training that he did for our team. I'll tell you, I had instant response. And so his training and his coaching in particular is really designed to create that instant impact and momentum.
You're very kind. Thanks, Justin.
No problem.
Well, that is great. Yeah, I believe it. I've only been on the air with you a few minutes, and I can only imagine how that would have been to be with you for several hours on end and the whole live experience and such. So that I'm sure that would would have been awesome. So, well, great. Well, thanks for coming on the show today. And folks, thanks for listening to the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. Remember, our shows are on iTunes. You can download our programs for free. We do that for you, and you can listen to our shows on iTunes. They're also archived on our LA Talk Radio page. So if you find us on Channel 2 and click the Concierge Coaches Show, our page comes up with our bios. And if you scroll in there, every show we've ever done is on archived on LA Talk Radio as well. And hopefully we'll have some exciting possible video formats and other stuff. I know Justin and our producers in Los Angeles are working on, so can't wait to see how that develops next. So with that in mind, I'll bid everybody a great afternoon, and we'll see you here next week, same time, on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. Have a great week, everybody.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.